Executive Director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, vice president for community and government relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Hello and welcome to WGTD's Education Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, Professor of Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Today, my guest is Sarah McDonald of the Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Sarah's primary goal as an educational developer is to advance teaching that is accessible, inclusive, and equitable for an increasingly diverse student population. To this end, she provides consultations and workshops on inclusive teaching practices and course design. In addition, Sarah specializes in conflict transformation, that is, engaging conflict constructively as a tool for teaching and learning. Prior to joining UW-Milwaukee, Sarah earned a PhD in ethics from Emory University with a concentration in religion, conflict, and peacebuilding. Her dissertation research grew out of her previous full-time work in international peacebuilding and nonviolent activism. She also holds an MA in English from the University of Iowa and a Master's of Divinity from McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago. This background informs all of Sarah's current work at UWM. Beyond serving at the Teaching Excellence Center, she is also a member of the Ombuds Council and teaches facilitation in the Master of Sustainable Peacebuilding Program. Welcome, Sarah McDonald. How are you today?
I am well. Thank you, Jonathan. And thank you so much for inviting me to be on this program with you.
I'm delighted. Full disclosure, you and I have met previously. We are co-facilitating a Wisconsin Dialogues workshop for educators across the UW system. That's not our topic today, but I thought that our listeners might be interested to know that we have that connection. So, Sarah, where to begin? You and I were having a chat just before this broadcast, and I told you that I am really interested in how an educator travels through their life to get to the place where they are now, how their own teaching and learning journey evolved. And I was wondering if you could give us a version of your own story.
Sure. So, as I was saying to you previously, the fact that I am an educator is not at all surprising to me. I come from a family of educators. My father was a math professor. My mother taught high school English. The value for education, for teaching and learning, runs very deep in my family. But what is surprising to me when I think about my life story, and particularly the earliest chapters, what does feel surprising is that I would focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion work, and particularly conflict transformation. Because, quite frankly, I grew up in a community in which neither one of these was emphasized. I'm from Maine originally. I was nurtured in a small, close-knit community that I would say was very white, middle class, very homogenous, quite conservative, and also, quite frankly, conflict avoidant. I think both by nature and by nurture, I absorbed this idea that, ooh, conflict signals there's a problem. It's something to be avoided. I learned to deal with a lot of hard things by just not talking about them.
Like a lot of
Yes. I think that's not at all unusual. and the journey that has brought me to where I am today has had a lot of twists and turns. And I think kind of one particularly key moment for me, and certainly the moment when I started really thinking about racism and racial justice happened when I was in college. And again, I was at a fairly small private Christian liberal arts college in the Midwest. Again, pretty white, pretty conservative. But this was in the early 90s. And during the LA riots in 1992, in response to police beating Rodney King and then the protests that erupted from that, I think across the nation, people were paying attention and responding. And this included at my little college in the Midwest. There were not many students of color on campus at the time, but some of those who were there started speaking out about, yeah, I've experienced racism in the dorms and here at this school. And one evening I went to the filming of a documentary that was sponsored by some campus organization. And quite honestly, I can't even tell you at this point what that documentary was, except that it was about race and racism and the forms that racism can take, implicit bias and stereotypical ideas of people of color. And I remember at points in the film realizing, oh, I have that idea too. Oh, I've thought in that way. And I ended the evening with a sense of, okay, Sarah, racism is not just this bad thing that is out there. It's in you as a white person as well. You have work to do. And it honestly, it was a moment that felt, it felt a bit like an epiphany, and it felt a lot like a calling. And it was, that's where I trace kind of my sense of anti-racism work, is work that is mine to do, work that I have to be engaged in. For the sake of the world, for the sake of people around me, but also for the sake of myself as well. That it touched me, and I needed to be actively educating myself and getting involved, and speaking up, learning how to speak up, learning how to participate in the struggle for justice.
Thank you for that.
That was really, really a pivotal moment for me, that then, you know, and it was an early step. You know, I still had a very thin understanding of racism. It was, I would say, many years later before I really started to think about racism in systemic terms and understand it much more broadly than just interpersonal prejudice or dislike of people who are different, but to think about how it's built into structures and institutions and needs to be addressed as such.
What was one of the systemic areas for racism that you first became aware of or that was impactful for you?
Well, so, I mean, absolutely, I would say as an educator, I spend a lot of time thinking about the system of education, and particularly higher education, because that's where I am located. And so, in a sense, like that's where I pay the keenest attention to how is it that racism shows up in our practices, to get really concrete, our teaching practices, how as instructors, or perhaps as departments, as whole units, we're structuring our grading policies, our expectations for what students should already know and be able to do before they even enter the class. What are our unspoken assumptions about how to succeed that are so customary to us that we don't even necessarily think about them. We don't articulate them out loud, but we just expect students to kind of figure them out and be able to navigate them.
So one of these things that might be invisible to an instructor, or maybe some students with a more privileged background, but is like a wall or a barrier or a trap for another student. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah. So I'll give you one example that I've heard increasingly talked about among instructors. So this may already be familiar to you, to some of your listeners, but it's a very concrete example. And that is the concept of office hours. And so those of us who are instructors or know well the world of instructors, we know that office hours signifies this is when the professor is available for students to come and talk to them. I think I said earlier, my father was a math professor. And so I kind of grew up knowing, oh, this is what office hours are. Like, I can't even remember a moment when I had to learn what that means. And when I started in college, I would note, oh, my professor of this writing course, when are his office hours? Because I'm going to take my first draft of my first paper into my instructor so I can get some feedback. I just knew that because I had grown up in a setting of educators, and I had kind of this insider knowledge of, oh, this is what an instructor is ready for. This is what I should be able to ask of my instructors. But for students coming from different backgrounds, who perhaps are the first in their family to attend college, the phrase office hours probably isn't going to connote, hey, students, this is when you go and talk with your professor.
Right. So it's about, you use the word inclusivity, as many of us do, an inclusive, warm, welcoming environment that where you're really connecting with students on a relational level and not just presenting them with information and assuming that they'll fill in the blanks.
Yes, absolutely. It is very, very much about the kind of environment and climate that we create as certainly as instructors, but I would say beyond that, as staff, as advisors, as librarians, as administrators, all of us together are working to create an atmosphere of welcome, an atmosphere that communicates to students, you in your individuality are not only welcomed here, but valued. You're bringing important gifts and perspectives and lived knowledge, lived experience that will enrich our learning environment. Yes.
Is this compatible with a course in math or hard science where the content or any, all college courses should, of course, be content rich and expand the horizons of students in terms of their learning? How does a teacher balance the need to connect with students on a personal level and to engage them in ways that feel relevant to the students, and at the same time bring all of this new information to them, these new perspectives, and to be rigorous in doing so? How does that all work together?
Yeah, and I'm very glad that you brought up the example of a math course because I think that there are fields and particularly perhaps more frequently in the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, where there's an idea of, well, our course content is not really about human identities. So therefore, inclusive teaching isn't really relevant to us. But that isn't true at all. In part because all of us, whatever our field, whatever our discipline, we're all teaching students who are human beings with identities, and they are bringing those identities into the classroom. And whether or not a student feels welcomed and included in the classroom, whether or not they have a sense of belonging, is going to have a direct impact on their learning. And I want to be clear here that it doesn't mean that, well, if a student is not feeling a sense of belonging, if they're in a classroom that isn't welcoming to them, it's impossible for them to learn. I mean, students have a lot, many students have a lot of grit and determination, and they can still learn, but it's just going to be that much harder for them. They're going to have additional barriers and challenges to overcome. And so I think a lot of our job as instructors and educators is to anticipate what are those additional barriers and challenges, and how can we remove them? And certainly one of the ways is creating a welcoming environment, which again, all of us can do regardless of what our field is. But another thing is being transparent, communicating really clearly with students. What is this course about? What are the essential learning outcomes? And how do they value to you? How do they matter to you in your lives, in your future careers? And what are the steps that you as a student can take to be meeting these outcomes, to be succeeding in this course? So again, it's going back to, I used the example of office hours as something where we take a term, we use it without necessarily thinking, hey, would that be clear to a student? Would it be clear to all students? And that's a fairly small example, but we need to do that kind of careful thinking about are we really clearly communicating with students in the assignments that we create? Are our instructions clear? Is the purpose of this assignment clear to students? Are we letting them know what's the grading criteria? What does a successful completed assignment look like in this case? Yeah, those are
That's really
some of
helpful.
the areas where we often have these unspoken assumptions that sometimes we're not even aware of. And if we're not thinking about it consciously, then we're probably not also communicating it very clearly to our students.
So this is really helpful in getting to understand you know, your perspective on teaching and learning and your passion, inclusivity, diversity. And I guess I'm also curious, and in terms of your work at UWM, how does the rubber hit the road when you're working with instructors? What issues do they bring to you, or how do you help them to work with their own materials? Could you perhaps say a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So instructors may come with a variety of questions. And some of the things that I've been talking about already, you know, are absolutely part of both the consultations and the workshops, the trainings in inclusive teaching that I offer.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm realizing one of the areas that I include in my inclusive teaching work that instructors have often responded to appreciatively, saying, wow, we really need help in this area. And that is the conflict transformation piece. And the form that this takes most concretely is talking about moments of conflict that may occur in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And how can an instructor handle those moments in ways that they can open up into learning opportunities rather than becoming tension-filled, difficult moments where the class discussion falls apart or students walk out of the classroom disillusioned or feeling like, ooh, I think I need to pull back and disengage a bit from this course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's about embracing conflict as an opportunity, not shying away from it, kind of.
To me, that is basic. To me, that's basic.
Mm-hmm.
And again, for me, that's a basic principle of conflict transformation.
Mm.
How do we shift our thinking about conflict from, ooh, conflict is a problem. It's a signal that something has gone wrong, and therefore I want to avoid it. I want to back away from it. I want to get out of this situation as quickly as I can.
Mm.
If I pretend it's not happening, maybe it will just go away. How do we shift from that kind of mindset to recognizing conflict is normal and natural and everyday, and it presents an opportunity for us to engage a different perspective, a new idea, a challenge, to engage that in a way that it becomes an opportunity for learning, for growth in the big picture, for possible positive social change.
So this is a wonderful topic. And let's, if it's okay with you, let's use the second half of our interview. We're already halfway through to really delve into this conflict transformation.
Absolutely.
This is WGTD's Education Matters. I'm your host, Jonathan Shaler. Our guest today is Sarah McDonald, teaching consultant at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And we're talking about conflict transformation right now. We just heard a wonderful definition of that from Sarah, and we're talking about this as it relates to teaching and learning in the classroom, and if it's community engaged learning, perhaps outside of the classroom.
Indeed.
Comprehensive. Indeed. So do you, you know, we've shared, you and I have shared some stories with each other about particular incidents or examples, and I was wondering if you would be okay if I shared a brief one with you for you to comment on from your perspective.
Sure.
maybe I'm a teacher who comes to you with a story about this. Okay. Mm-hmm. So this happened some time ago, but it stayed with me as a really vivid example of conflict in the classroom as related to social identity and something that just happens in the moment that cannot be planned for necessarily. So as a communication instructor, introductory level class with about 50 students, most of them white, but about 15 African-American students who tended to sit together in the classroom. Mm-hmm. We were talking about communication competence, and I believe I was quoting something from a text by Paul Watzlawick on communication competence, and he was giving an example of what he thought was a brilliant maneuver by a police officer. And it was a situation where somewhere in, I think it was South Central Los Angeles, a police officer had pulled a woman over for a minor traffic violation. But right at that intersection across the street, a crowd began to gather. He was a white officer. This is an African-American neighborhood. A crowd began to gather, and he was getting a lot of attention, and he was concerned about how much attention this, what he thought was a routine traffic stop, was receiving. Mm-hmm. So as he was getting back into his vehicle, he chose to reframe was the communication term that was used here, to reframe the situation from one that was perhaps seen in a negative light by the gathering, to make it more mundane. And he simply turned to the crowd and said, "You've just witnessed the issuance of a traffic citation by your Los Angeles County police officer." And he got back into his vehicle. So the author of the text, Paul Watzlawick, celebrated this as a moment of reframing and an example of how an officer diffused a potentially explosive situation. When I shared that with my students, the class immediately polarized, and the white student, as we discussed this, I asked them, do you agree with Watzlawick? Does this seem like an effective example of reframing? And the white students were like, absolutely. I mean, he was doing his job. He was doing it well. He did it in a straightforward way. And he explained to, this potentially hostile crowd that, what he was doing. And that seemed to diffuse the situation. And a number of the black students were shaking their heads. And one of them said, if that happened in my neighborhood, he would have gotten whooped. And the white students were taken aback by this, and I think it might have confirmed for some of them some kind of stereotype they had about how black people might, deal with this kind of situation. So it got pretty thick, pretty fast. Mm-hmm. But I wish I could tell you how skillfully I facilitated the conversation at that point. I don't think I did badly, but I just don't recall. I just remember that it was a very interesting moment where we had very different responses to what was going on in that example. And what I chose to do was to talk about it rather than to try to shut down the discussion. That was the most important thing.
Good. Yes.
Yeah. So any further thoughts? Maybe I answered my own question, but I just interested in any thoughts you might have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you definitely anticipated for me what is the key fundamental thing I try to encourage instructors. In a moment like this, there are many different possible things that we can say or do. What's most important is that we say or do something to acknowledge the conflict and the tension and its importance. It's more important in this moment that we are present authentically than that we say the perfect articulate thing. And I always land heavily on this because I think for many of us, the fear of saying the wrong thing in the moment stops us from saying anything at all. Perfectionism becomes the cage that holds us back. And I think it is okay. It is sometimes very good in these moments to let ourselves be a human being with feelings and anxieties and feeling tensions and feeling challenged. Just speaking concretely and practically, I often urge instructors in this moment, pay attention to what you're feeling, particularly what you're feeling in your body. And it is okay to pause. It is okay to say something like, wow, I can feel that the tension in the room has really risen. And I need it. I need us to pause for a moment. I'm feeling this tension. I imagine some of you are also feeling it. And we need to pay attention to this because it's telling us something important. And this is an opportunity for us to be learning. You know, even if that's all we know to say in the moment, to say something, if we as instructors are feeling the need ourselves, or if we sense, okay, the class right now would really benefit from taking a short little break so we can kind of breathe a little bit and regroup. If the instructor needs a couple minutes to think, okay, how am I going to structure the discussion? How do I want to continue this? I wasn't expecting it to go in this direction, but clearly we need to. So let me take a couple minutes to rethink, replan. That's fine. That's fine. Sometimes inviting our students to take a few minutes to do some reflective writing and think about what they're feeling. My advisor has some questions, some wonderful questions that she often uses during conflict moments. Ask students to reflect on what is one thing that I know for sure, and what is one thing that I'm wondering about? Or what is one question that I have?
I like it. This idea of a pause, being willing to take that pause, recognizing that something's going on, and seeing both yourself and your students as human beings who are embodied,
and
who are experiencing something now, and that needs to be attended to.
Yes. And I think the more we as instructors are able to respond to these moments with a conviction that this is an opportunity for all of us to learn, rather than this is an opportunity in which I as a teacher need to assert my authority, or I as a teacher need to make sure that things are going smoothly. Or I imagine for some students, the way they might experience this moment is, this is a moment in which I need to defend my position. So if we can ourselves see it as a learning opportunity, then we can more readily help our students see it also as a learning opportunity.
It's interesting. Go ahead.
Oh, and I also want to be clear about, like, this particular example you've mentioned. It's a learning opportunity for all of the students in the classroom, but it's also a learning opportunity in different ways. And so for example, for one of your white students in that moment, very likely this is a learning opportunity to understand a lived experience and a perspective that's different from their own and maybe very new. For the Black students in the class, it's going to be a different kind of learning experience. Quite possibly, I would even say very likely, the perspectives of their white classmates are not going to be new in quite the same way. So for them, it's likely a different kind of a learning opportunity.
Like, how do I address what this white person is saying now that I'm not just talking about this with my friends after the fact? I'm in the room with this white person and I have an opportunity to speak with them directly and ask them questions and tell them how I'm
feeling. Maybe it's an opportunity for a student to learn something about themselves and their own emotional reactions and what they want to do with those emotional reactions. You know, I mean, maybe there are some students who in that moment have a sense of, wow, I'm feeling really weary that once again, I'm a minoritized voice here and I have knowledge coming from my lived experience and I'm suddenly in a position of needing to educate others in the room and I'm feeling really weary in this moment. And again, I don't want to pretend that I know kind of what it is that that student needs to learn, but even just an invitation to the student, listen to what you're feeling inside yourself, what's going on in your head, from a perspective of what do I have to learn from this? About myself, about what I do and don't want to do, about how I want to keep learning and growing, or particular boundaries that I realize I need to draw.
Yeah. I'm curious if we could go back in time for a moment as to your own experience in maybe divinity school, maybe with peace and reconciliation training. Very interested in learning more about how that's influenced you and your perspective.
Sure. And I'm glad you asked that because these were really formative experiences that I would say brought me into the field of conflict transformation. So when I started working on my MDiv, I entered seminary not exactly knowing what I wanted to do with this degree afterwards, but I was very clear that I felt a sense of calling to, at the time, I would have used the language of peacemaking work, reconciliation work, what I now think of more as anti-racism, justice activism, nonviolence, although I wasn't necessarily using that language at the start of my seminary studies. But I was very, very clear that was the kind of work that I felt passionate about and called to be engaging in, in ways that for me were also very cross-cultural and asked me to stretch myself in challenging ways. It was while I was a seminary student that I connected with the organization that then after seminary, I ended up working with full-time for a few years. And that is CPT. At the time, it was called Christian Peacemaker Teams. More recently, this organization has changed their name to Community Peacemaker Teams. So still I call it CPT. Mm-hmm. And CPT grew out of the historic peace churches, Mennonites, Brethren, Quakers, really with the mandate to how do we live into our peace theologies and our convictions in proactive ways in the world that will further peace and genuine justice. Mm-hmm. And I took what my seminary considered an internship year and trained with CPT, started doing some work. I should back up and explain a little bit more the work that CPT actually does. CPT sends teams of trained peacemakers and I would say nonviolent activists to situations in contexts in the world that are experiencing some kind of war or lethal conflict.
Mm.
CPT only goes to places where there's an invitation from local peacemakers, nonviolent activists, community leaders who are already there working in the situation. And they say, yes, we would value the help and the support of an international group coming in to accompany us, to engage in solidarity activism, to help magnify attention to what's going on here. And so this is the kind of work that CPT engages in. I started doing this as a seminary student, and then after graduation carried on full time in this work, which is really about supporting grassroots nonviolent resistance movements around the world. And that was kind of my very practical introduction to conflict transformation. And recognizing in a deep way for conflict to be constructive and fruitful and lead toward change, we need to lean into it rather than lean away. And then as I made my way back into educational context, that's the fundamental principle that I've brought with me into this work. And as you can hear, that influences then how I talk about instructors, how I talk with instructors about how we can use conflict really as a tool for inclusive teaching and potentially transformative learning.
Mm. And you teach in the Master of Sustainable Peacebuilding program.
I do. I do. Yes. Yes. And for that, I mean, I draw both on my background as a full-time nonviolent activist, my PhD studies, which focused really on conflict and peace building. But it happens that the particular course I teach is about facilitation as a peace building practice.
Mm.
And so literally what I'm doing in the classroom as a teacher is facilitation. These are the skills that I'm trying to teach to students in this class, give them opportunities to practice this. And so many of the same skills that I'm also trying to help instructors learn so that they can engage their classes in these potentially transformative ways.
What a wonderful, rich array of tools you have to offer teachers and students at the university, and based on a really amazing backstory that has really prepared you to dig into these issues. Sarah McDonald of the Teaching Excellence Center, I know I'm saying it wrong, at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's been wonderful talking with you today.
This has been WGTD's Education Matters, and have a nice day.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org.
This is WGTD HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's hosted by Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College, Jenny Tunkeys, former reporter